Welcome to Breaking Banks, the number one global fintech radio show and podcast. I'm Brett King.
And I'm Jason Henricks. Every week since 2013, we explore the personalities, startups, innovators, and industry players driving disruption in financial services.
From incumbents to unicorns, and from cutting-edge technology to the people using it to help create a more innovative, inclusive, and healthy financial future. I'm JP Nichols, and this is Breaking Banks.
Hello and welcome to Women in FinTech, a Breaking Banks initiative bringing females into focus in the wild and wonderful world of FinTech. I'm your host, Chloe James. Look, it's no secret that financial services generally, technology and FinTech are industries dominated by men. According to the National Science Foundation, women account for only 28% of all computer science and engineering STEM roles, and in FinTech specifically, making up a meager 30% of the entire workforce. A 2018 study conducted by Lend Academy revealed that 37% of employees in FinTech are women, with 83% of those companies saying they have adopted a formal gender equality policy, which is something at least. When we consider the entire financial services industry, according to the World Economic Forum's Global Gender Gap Report, although women account for 46% of financial services employees, less than 15% of those percent are executives. These stats, of course, extending to board positions, even though it's been proven time and time again that women on boards directly correlates to a company's success. So it seems there is work to be done. Yet, amongst our male peers outlined, you will find some of the brightest, most vocal and experienced women bringing FinTech to the fore. If only there were more of us, we are working on it. What we lack in numbers, we more than make up for in insight, skill and expertise, and that is what we are here to share. So, joining me for this very first show are two of the greats. Joanne Barefoot is a regular contributor to Breaking Banks, the original, and the CEO and co-founder at Alliance for Innovative Regulation. Joanne is a writer, speaker, advisor, investor, and author on all things relating to regulation, innovation, and fintech. She has also been charged by an Alaska brown bear, which sounds like a whole episode in itself. Joanne, welcome.
It's lovely to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. Also needing no introduction, but of course I'm going to give her one, is Dr. Lida Glyptis. Lida is a recovering banker, lapsed academic, team and venture builder, tech geek, speaker, advisor, and all-weather optimist. Lida has served as the CEO of cloud-native core banking platform 11FS Foundry, chief innovation officer at QNB, the largest bank in the Middle East and Africa, and as innovation lead and process re-engineering lead across a variety of departments at BNY Mellon, the largest custody bank in the world. Lida has worked as a consultant and advisor with a variety of banks and FIs of all sizes across several markets. She is also a regular speaker on tech diversity and digital transformation. Hashtag Lida Writes for FinTech Futures every Thursday. I'm sure a lot of you have caught that series. She is a great person, supporter and friend. Welcome, Lida.
So good to be here with you today.
Thank you. So you're joining us from Athens and Joanne is in Washington, D.C. as I sit here in Toronto, Canada.
A truly international footprint.
It absolutely is. So as I said, we've got a great show here today. Thank you both so much for joining me. I'm going to dive straight in. We've got a lot to get through. I want to kick off with you both a really big question that's just about you, actually, which is when and why FinTech? What got you and what has kept you in it as an industry? Joanne, did you want to kick us off?
I'd love to. Thank you. So I've always been a technophile. I came from a family of engineers. And when my son was wasting his life playing computer games in middle school, I was interested enough to take a close look and realize there was something important going on there that wasn't just wasting his life.
Yep.
But I went in a different direction. I have spent most of my career trying to build financial inclusion and consumer financial health through regulation. I have been a bank regulator. I was deputy controller of the currency in U.S. I've worked for the U.S. Senate. I've worked at big four firms. I've started my own firms and sold them to big four firms. And been a consultant in the space and realized that we were not solving the problems of financial inclusion and financial health at all in the Great Recession. Mm-hmm. We had millions of people who were harmed by mortgages that were completely compliant with the laws that we had. And we have millions of people who can't get into the mainstream financial system and who can't, who are harmed by it if they do get in. And somewhere along the way, I realized that we could do more with technology than we're doing with regulation. Not that we don't need regulation, we do. Mm-hmm. But FinTech emerged and started solving the problems of financial access, affordability, clarity, transparency, fairness, and the rest of it. And I went to Harvard for 2 years as a senior fellow to write a book on this and had the epiphany that while this great opportunity was there, we were probably going to regulate it wrong just because the regulators didn't weren't up to speed. So I sort of appointed myself to solve that problem. Mm-hmm. And wrote papers at Harvard, and now I have founded this nonprofit, AIR, that is working on that problem. So putting together the opportunity with my regulatory background.
Fabulous. And have you seen a lot of development over your years in fintech and then marrying that together with the regulation piece? Are you seeing a lot of progress, would you say?
I'm very, very optimistic that the regulatory system is in motion. It's developing momentum, realizing that the financial industry is digitizing and the regulators are going to have to do the same thing just to keep up with the industry they're trying to oversee. Mm. And I see progress all over the world, courageous regulators, creative regulators, who are really moving to modernize our regulatory system and bring it into the digital age.
Mm, that's fabulous. I mean, I've read a lot of work from the World Economic Forum on regulation in financial services. I spent actually a lot of my early career with the Australian Securities and Investments Commission and then moved over to the Financial Services Authority in London. So I hear you that it was, you know, it's obviously a very challenging area to really technify, if you like, if we can make that a word. And it's great to see that there's some work, a lot of work and a lot of progress going on in that development. We're going to come on to a lot more, Joanne, but Lita, why fintech for you? It's funny, we've sat down so many times and had so many great chats, but I don't actually know what really kind of piqued your interest in that real tech side of financial services.
You know, it's funny, I'm listening to Joanne's story and thinking, quick, make something up, because I don't have a great origin story. My story starts with a complete serendipitous accident, and a very, very happy one at that. But I found myself entirely accidentally falling sideways into operations and IT banking early on in my career, which is not every little girl's dream, let me tell you. Yeah. But it is actually, it should be. Because it's where you learn how the plumbing works. It's where you learn how money circulates. And if you want to change it, you kind of need to understand how it is now and why. So I found myself entirely accidentally in that industry. Surprisingly, both enjoyed it and found I was good at it, with a background in politics and a PhD in the rise of political Islam. Let me tell you, this was not obvious. This was not how things were meant to pan out. And I found myself, as I said, it was accident and serendipity. I found myself at the right place in the right time yeah. to catch the wave that became the fintech revolution from day zero. And that meant that by accident, curiosity, some hard work, but a lot of luck, I grew with the space as it grew in a way that you couldn't replicate today. Mm. There was a time when you could be with a regulator talking about why cloud isn't scary in the morning, and with an AI company in the afternoon, and fighting the great API battle, and all in one day. Today, you would have 10 departments doing that. So I was lucky to catch it from the beginning. I was lucky to fall into something that I ended up loving and being good at. Mm-hmm. And honestly, as the last, you know, whichever way you want to start the clock on this, the last 10, 15 years have evolved. We've reached a point of such profound transformation of how our industry operates, how our duty of care towards the communities we serve is conceptualized, that I have felt one of those historic, where were you during that transformation moments? And I felt extremely lucky to be part of this. The interest in tech again, I think was a moment in time thing, because I'm not an engineer. And although I understand enough to cause trouble and cause damage, I would never see myself as bringing engineering talent. But again, because of the moment of profound transformation in the business model, the monetization model, the regulation and the tech, there was space for people like myself who can synthesize and bring all of that together. Whether there will be space for someone like me in 10 years time, God knows, but thankfully I don't have to answer that now.
And thankfully it's working now. Look, I love that. I love that you've brought the serendipitous moments and that sometimes it is accidental. I would 100% feel the same, to be quite honest. I was kind of right in the thick of regulation. I was mentioning the Financial Services Authority. I moved to London in May 2008. So you do the math there, and it was just as the GFC happened. So I was working for the British regulator when the world just exploded, the economy just exploded, and it actually was, you know, it was really fortuitous that that happened. I always say the worst thing for the global economy was the best thing for my career, because I was working in the press office actually at the time with Hector Sants, the CEO, and it was just, it was so exciting and dynamic, even though it was obviously something really horrific that happened. And then I love as well, Lita, that you've spoken there about the care factor, and that's something that's really, that I love about fintech, is I think that so much of development that's come out of fintech and the sort of wave of it is about this care factor and this true care for the customer, which I know you are both hugely passionate about. I want to thank you both for those amazing stories there. I do want to talk now about COVID, the time of COVID. It's taken me however many minutes to mention that word, but listen, around about now, we would all usually be converging at events around the world, right? So Money 2020, Cybos, Inner Tribe, FinTech Connect, the list goes on. We'd be getting stuck into the thick of all the latest happenings in our industry, not to mention the cocktail parties, which I remember well as well. But due to, COVID, we are not. So I just wanted to know how you're both going amongst COVID. And what I really do want to hear and what I think is really valuable for listeners are, what are the biggest impacts of the last 6 months on our industry? Because it's been massive, right? And I've had a number of conversations about how, again, maybe like the GFC, perhaps it's a good thing. Perhaps it's been something that's really pushed the needle as far as behaviours and attitudes and, you know, changes towards the financial services industry. Joanne, how have you been going in the last 6 months with everything that's happening? And I've also mentioned here you're based in the States where, you know, there's a lot going on.
Yeah, that's for sure. So those of us who work in innovation spend a lot of time thinking about how good things sometimes arise out of bad things, terrible crises and problems. I know Brett King quotes the statistics on the Great Plague, and I do too. You know, the Great Plague killed a third of the population of Europe. It's a terrible, terrible thing. And yet coming out of it, it ended the feudal system. It laid the groundwork for a middle class to emerge. It gave laborers, you know, bargaining power. I think we're in that kind of a situation, despite the terrible pain and heartbreak of COVID. We are seeing tremendous positive results in the areas that we work in. I talked to a regulator recently who said that the prior crisis, the Great Recession that you just talked about, froze up regulatory or tech innovation in finance, paralyzed it at the time. And she said, this one is accelerating it. And I agree with that. Everything that was in motion before, the whole world is moving to online and digital channels where we can. People are learning how to do it. More people are coming in to these ways of living. And that is pouring rocket fuel on things that were in motion before and accelerating them and making it much more possible to do things faster. Mm-hmm. So I'm very optimistic about it. I mentioned that that my son had a misspent youth. He later became a bank regulator, and he and I later founded a firm together, a reg tech firm that is working on anti-money laundering. And you know, the ability to take a terrible problem like money laundering that's paying for human trafficking and terrorism and weapons trafficking and actually tackle it with great technology today, all of this kind of thing is accelerating directly out of the COVID crisis.
Mm. It's just so interesting how that's such an, I've never heard that before, but you know, the GFC paralyzing things and then COVID is accelerating. I think that's a really big gold nugget of this conversation. Actually, I noticed as well, Joanne, when I was just reading up about you before today, that you're involved with the Milken Institute, which I know they do so much work about, you know, this, well, things like, you know, money, anti-money laundering and human trafficking. And can you touch on a little bit of what you do with them? Because I know you work with FinTech, with Milken.
Absolutely, yes. I'm on their FinTech Advisory Council or Committee, and which is an amazing group.
Mm.
Mainly we look at, we have a group of FinTechs on the committee, and we look at the policy issues that are emerging and think about what education is needed or what action is needed to be sure that emerging policy will enable FinTech to flourish in terms of the good things it can do while also dealing with the downside risk. So for example, as you probably know, in the US, we do not have a national privacy law on the model, say, of Europe and GDPR.
Mm.
We probably will in the next few years. How can we shape that so that it will enable data to be used for good and not to harm people? So the Milken Institute works on really interesting problems like that at the nexus of the technology sector and the public sector.
Mm, fabulous. Lita, how are things going with you and with COVID, and you're based in Europe? I sort of mentioned you're in Athens at the moment, but I know you're based in London on a more permanent basis. How are you seeing the industry faring at the moment?
So I must admit that listening to Joanne was uplifting for me, because the view is high, a little higher level than where I operate, a little more holistic and much more optimistic. At the institution by institution level, I see a mixed bag. I see a lot of, I see humans being more themselves. So the good ones are going out of their way to help each other, and the bad ones are having meltdowns and showing their true colors. So in that sense, it's brilliant. And on a human level, I've seen an incredible sense of community emerge, people coming together to help each other, startups come together to release tools to help individuals and other companies. So I've seen a lot of all the stuff that is the best and the greatest of our industry come to the fore. And I actually published a piece last week on how I'd like to see the European regulator look at what has happened, pat organizations on the back for what their humans have taken upon themselves to do, because some truly superhuman effort has been made to put tools and loans and solutions in the hands of consumers, but also take a stand on the fact that systemic agility is sorely lacking, in Europe at least, and with the organizations I work with. But I've had experience in the US and in Asia, and I would say it's an industry-wide thing. We know that quite a lot of our infrastructure isn't fit for the digital world. I totally agree with Joanne that we're seeing a relentless push in that direction. But if you look at an organization-by-organization level, the banks have had expected return on equity and expected deliverables and expected projects and expected projections for the year. All those expectations went out the window with COVID, but most organizations are looking at where they're at and trying to close the gap rather than reinvent themselves, which is entirely understandable. But we know that their humans rallied, because very few banks failed to deliver and rise up to the crisis, which is amazing. But almost none did so through strength of their digital infrastructure. And to Joanne's point, the push from a regulatory perspective is towards essentially systemic agility being a requirement. The push from a consumer perspective, from a need, willingness, and adoption, is definitely going that way. The infrastructure is lagging. And what I haven't seen yet is that bold realization of, okay, we've all been hit quite hard, but this thing is not a surprise. We knew that we had some challenges around technical infrastructure pinning our digital capabilities. This thing might happen again. Let's not let's not rely on the humans right through the night to cope.
I mean, there can be these sort of second waves, can't they, that we're sort of seeing through happen throughout the world. And we've got a long way to go. I mean, I'm not sure if you would both agree. I think I was fairly naive back in March, and it all sort of, well, it actually kind of kicked off last November, but in March this year when it really started to shut things down, and I thought, oh, this will be over soon. And oh, how naive I was. I mean, here we are in August and I'm,
you know, 100%.
Going to be going right through to the next year. Perhaps I'm the eternal optimist like you, Lita, but it's really interesting to see. You're talking about some of the organisations you've been working with. Is there anyone that you'd cite who, you know, have kind of done things really well, have been, you know, that you've been impressed by perhaps their response to the crisis?
I'd say that I've been impressed by the humans' response to the crisis.
Yeah.
How people saw themselves rally and saw themselves responsible for other humans. And I find that inspiring and inspirational. I mean, DMB, I'll name drop them because I find the way they approach this absolutely brilliant. They see their mission as keeping Norway running.
Mm.
So the way that they approached their duty of care was inspired by exactly that. Yeah. And I would say I'd put them top of that list, but they're not alone. Every single bank I worked with, where the teams, the leadership, almost down tools and everything else, and focused 100% on providing solutions for small businesses, for individuals, payment holidays, this and that. So to answer your question, yes, but have I seen a bank that had the right infrastructure in place and could do the interest rate changes at the flick of a button in 30 seconds, which is what it should take? No, not one.
I mean, that's a tough one, isn't it? Sometimes I've been thinking about, you know, some of the very large organizations, you know, just having to keep the lights on and actually having to, you do so much work in digital transformation, like organizational transformation, and you're trying to deliver to the customer, right? But within the bank, it has to be, you know, working digitally flawlessly itself. And this is when you've suddenly got hundreds of thousands of people working from home and then making that work and then on to the customer. But anyway, interesting stuff. Lita, I do want to stay with you for the next question, and then I'm going to go back to Joanne. But it is this women question, and I know that you have a view on this. And it's, you know, this is our podcast and we're talking about women in fintech. Why aren't there more of us? And if, when, and how do you see it changing?
Well, I've been thinking about that a lot over the last few years, as you know, and you're right, I do have views on this. I think there are a few factors, and they all start much before you get to the top. You know, how many boardrooms have you walked into and you're the only woman? Too many, probably all of them. But it does start much earlier. Both tech and financial services have not been industries that women in my generation when we were finishing school sought careers in. I think that is changing, but not as fast as it should. I think there's an element of that. Building up expertise in the core of the business is important. I was speaking to someone you also know well, Chloe, who's an advocate for the representation of women in the industry, and she was brutal. She said, if you strip out the marketing, PR, human resources, legal, risk, not because they don't matter, but because they have interchangeable skill sets and they moved sideways into this industry. So if you strip out all the corporate functions and you leave pure tech and pure finance, the number of women in the industry are not even enough for a list, let alone, you know. So I think there's an element of the way women chose careers 20 years ago is definitely in play. There are definitely microaggressions and unpleasantness in the industry that some women are like, is this worth it? But I have this theory, and it's a new theory, and it's not genius by any means, but I feel very strongly about this, and I don't think we've talked about it, definitely not since you've had a child. But I have recently decided that the single most meaningful and most impactful thing that we can do as an industry is equal compulsory parental leave. Because if I had a penny for every time I've either been asked or sort of nudged towards the direction of indicating my marital status and whether I have children before I was given a senior role, I'd be a very rich woman. And I think it happens a lot, whether it happens consciously or unconsciously. So the combination of education, encouraging women to go into STEM, but also the biggest obstacle is that, I mean, I've been in meetings in banks where people are like, well, will she go off on maternity though if we give her this job? Equal compulsory parental leave. Yep. It is not the one thing that will fix everything, but I think it will be the single most impactful thing we can do.
I love it. Thank you for that. Yes, I did have a daughter last year. So I have a one-year-old who I'm certainly going to be getting into tech. 100%. And funnily enough, it's interesting you should say that, but my husband is actually currently the primary caregiver for her and I'm working. So there you go. But yes, I agree with you. It should be mandatory. Joanne, your view here, really keen to hear your view on women in our industry and if you see this shifting as well and how.
There is a great book, by the way, Coding for Babies, that you want to give right off the bat as a baby gift.
Okay. I love it.
So as Lita said, fintech is the merging of two completely male-dominated industries. One is old and one is newer. They both ended up male-dominated. I think one of the things that has to happen is that technology is going to dominate this century, and technology as a sector is dominated by the founders. And so one of the answers is we need many, many more women founders. There's a lot of pieces that have to come into place for that, but I think we need to be focusing on getting the founders with a much more diversity, gender-wise and race-wise also.
Yeah.
I also think that we need to just put an end to the bro culture, the Me Too movement. If you had told me when I was a young woman that we were going to have the Me Too phenomenon going on here at this late date and tolerated and covered up by corporate and government organizational institutional reflexes, I would never have believed it. We just have to agree together to change that. And then to take inspiration from the worldwide phenomenon that has occurred in the police killing of George Floyd and the Black Lives Matter movement for both people of color and gender diversity. We just all need to be much more proactive and think harder. We need to diversify our workspaces and our boardrooms and our social circles and our family gatherings, everything that we do.
Yeah.
And just try harder. And I know you're out of time and you were going to ask us about advice, and my advice is very short. I always give the same advice.
Okay, love it. Please do.
It is never fear. Don't be afraid.
Okay, I love it. Lita, do you want to give us some advice quickly?
I'd love to. The best advice I've ever gotten was actually from my grandfather, and it was, never decide what you're going to do first. Think who you are, and that will determine everything, particularly when the choice is hard.
Oh, I just love it. I love both of your phrases there, Lita. I've got something stuck on my fridge that I've had on my fridge for about probably 8 years now that says, know thyself. And it's basically to your point of your grandfather's advice there, know thyself and be true to yourself, and that's the only person you can be. There's everybody else is taken, and I love the no fear piece as well. Listen, so fabulous to speak with you both. I'm sure I'm going to have you back on the show. Just quickly, where can we find out more about you, hear from you? Lita, just a little bit on Lita Writes, and then Joanne, if you can just chat a little bit about where we can hear from you.
My pleasure. So I'm at Lita Gliptis on Twitter and Lita Gliptis on LinkedIn. Lita Writes on Thursdays, FinTech Futures, mostly about leadership transformation and come on people, we can do better.
Yeah, and magic mistakes.
Magic mistakes, yes.
I read that yesterday and I absolutely loved it. Everyone check out Lita's posts. They're amazing. They're such a fun and great read, really, in her voice. Joanne, where can we hear more from you?
I am on Twitter at Joanne Barefoot, and our AIR website is regulationinnovation.org. I have a podcast called Barefoot Innovation, and at our AIR website, we have just put out a RegTech manifesto on transforming financial regulation for the digital age, and we're launching the regulatory design project to bring the whole financial system into the digital age from a regulatory information side. And it's exciting, and we hope everyone will get involved. Our manifesto is a request for comments, so we would love to have comments on the website.
Fabulous. When you check out Joanne, go to the About Me section and read the list of things that Joanne has done in her life, because I read them yesterday, my Sunday afternoon, and it just blew me away. So there you go. Listen, that's it for today. Thank you so much to my guests. I can't wait to see you in person, both of you, whenever that may be, who knows. Thanks for joining us, and we really hope you enjoyed it. If you have anyone that you want to hear from or recommend for the podcast, we'd love to hear from you. I'm Chloe James. Please join us for the next episode of Breaking Banks, Women in FinTech.
Masterclass, where you learn from the biggest names and the brightest minds, is my new obsession. Steve Martin, right in my living room to teach me comedy? Yes, please. Thomas Keller sharing his secrets for the perfect soup? I'll sign up. Judy Blume helping me write better? What could be better than that? Where to start? You learn anywhere, anytime, through 85 courses. Start and stop whenever you want. You don't have to commit to listening through the whole thing. So for my first course, I opted for Basketball Fundamentals with Stephen Curry, so I'm ready for the Hendricks family rematch. Trust me when I tell you, it is going to take someone the caliber of Stephen Curry and the way Masterclass delivers these classes to make me competitive with my wife on the basketball course. Well, guess what? It's working. I skipped to the lesson on ball handling since I could start practicing in our driveway right away. I always thought my hands were the issue. Turns out, I needed to improve my posture. I have so much to learn and so many topics that excite me. Masterclass has an answer for all of them. Learning from the masters, hearing their stories, and having them bring this to life is amazing. I highly recommend you check it out. Get unlimited access to every masterclass, and as a Breaking Banks listener, you get 15% off an annual membership. Go to masterclass.com/banks. That's masterclass.com/banks for 15% off Masterclass. Now stay tuned to find out if Stephen Curry can really give me game. Otherwise, I suspect I'll be using the skills learned from Thomas Keller to settle the bet with my wife.
I want to talk to just our banker listeners for a minute. We're entering the budgeting and planning season, and this one is filled with more uncertainty and risk than ever before. That's why Alloy Labs is conducting a virtual digital strategy collab on September 10th. And Breaking Banks listeners can save $200 at alloylabs.com/workshop. This is way more than a webinar. You'll benefit from multiple bank perspectives as you learn hands-on how to allocate what are always limited resources to defend and extend your existing business while also creating viable options for the future. Go to alloylabs.com/workshop to register now. Space is extremely limited. Times of great change are also times of great opportunity, and the time to act is now. alloylabs.com/workshop.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
And now, here's more Breaking Banks.
Hi, my name is Dara Tarkowski. I'm the host of the Tech on Reg podcast at Provoke.fm. Tech on Reg explores all things at the intersection of law, technology, and highly regulated industry. We're talking about fintech and reg tech, cannabis, and sex tech. Join me and thought leaders from around the world to discuss how to pursue responsible innovation.
In 2016, four banking and technology leaders set out to revolutionize the world of payments processing. Form 3 disrupted the traditional payments infrastructure model and built from scratch an award-winning, cloud-native, payments-as-a-service platform. Today, Form 3 is trusted by some of the UK and Europe's biggest Tier 1 banks and fast-growing fintechs to handle their critical payments architecture. From this vantage point, the team at Form 3 and their venture capital backers had particular insight into what is defining the winners and the losers, the response by the incumbents to the digital insurgents, and how the future is being shaped. Today, Michael Muller, CEO of Form3, and Vinath Jayakumar, partner at Draper Esprit. Financial services has really been late to the party when it comes to things like cloud, API, digital transformation in general, but it has been going on for over 10 years now, but it really seems there's been an explosion lately in the move to cloud. And Michael, I want to maybe start with you. Can you talk about Form3 in terms of when you got started and how over this time period you've seen this landscape change?
Yeah, sure. So I'm actually a banker by background. So I've worked in financial services for most of my career and started the company about 4 years ago. And at that stage, it was quite interesting because we're kind of on the verge of cloud computing becoming a thing in financial services for many different applications. And I think what we've seen since is basically that it has been taken center stage and has become a lot more important for financial institutions where they look at cloud native architecture as part of their core stack. So 4 years ago, that was an idea, a hunch, something that we thought might happen. And it's really great to see that it is happening now. And, someone said the other day, it's not a lot of question marks around the user cloud because, in many of those conversations, you would say, as opposed to what? And, the interesting development that we're seeing right now is that most of the exciting technology in financial services is building cloud native architecture, component-based architecture and everything and all the benefits that come with that.
I'm curious, as a venture capitalist, what was your theme as you look at cloud and cloud native and APIs? How do you dissect the environment?
I think the driving principle for us at the time was we had made an investment into a company called Revolut, which is a digital challenger bank. And they had completely reinvented what banking looked like, where they didn't have the traditional stuff you did, where you made all the money you credit, that didn't really exist. And so when we dug a little bit deeper into that, what we realized was actually it was a reinvention of the cost structure within banking, right? So most of the banks have a very heavy cost income ratio. It's ranging between 70, 80. Back in the days, it used to be as high as 90%+. And so off the back of that, we were thinking about actually which thematics here are the big layers of what we think will drive costs down. And payments is one of the biggest elements of that. And so when we got talking to Michael and his team, the first thematic there that we were hearing, one from the banks and from Michael and his team, was actually there is this shift towards cloud-native banking. What does that really mean? It means that you take a huge layer of cost out of what you were doing before, right? And you do it in a much more efficient format. So in the case of Form3, for example, if just by the nature of how it's set up, API first, multi-tenanted, single instance, it just means, when the team at Form3 fixed a problem, it's fixed for all clients. And so there is a sort of a network effect that is kind of accruing in the company. And therefore, every bank that's sort of onboarded onto the platform is benefiting from that. And I think when we see more of that playing out, we can see value accruing in that kind of company. And that for us was a huge sort of tick in the box with Michael and the team at Form3.
I think that's massively overlooked. When we think about challenger banks, it's often the beauty of the interface or the fact that they've made, sexy new card or how it's delivered, the N26s that are so proud of, the application takes less than 2 minutes, which, there's some value there. But the real underlying strategic value when you've dropped your cost structure so significantly, you can really evolve your business model. But the big banks, they're beginning to catch up. How does that begin to play out now? What, is the writing on the wall for the challengers?
Well, I wouldn't say the writing is on the wall for the challengers, and certainly not for that reason. But you're right. Our first customers were the N26s and the challenger banks, a lot of the payment service providers, so people with a cloud native stack for other applications. Quick decision making, easy integration is very important in that space. And therefore, that's where we started. What happened in the past 2 years was basically that the big banks, they did wake up and wherever they're looking at buying new technology, they look at the same technology that the challengers are using. And so there is a bit of a transformation going on. There's a massive transformation going on, and we're only seeing the beginning of that.
One of the things I'd add to that is you know, this is an interesting debate, right? And I think it's Form3 are one of many companies that will come up against this debate. Is selling to a challenger bank is a lot easier because they understand the stack that they're buying and they also understand how they're paying for it. One of the debates we've had with the big banks is, you know, are you okay with a SaaS model? How would you pay for this out of a CapEx budget versus an OpEx budget? And, you know, do you understand that this scales with the value volume of payments going up, and what does that do for your budgets? And making them change how they think about buying technology has been an interesting shift. And, you know, Michael can tell you that firsthand. You know, first of all, there's the shift from going from on-prem to private cloud to public cloud. And then now there's even talk about multi-cloud. You know, we're kind of thinking ahead here, but I think we're not quite there in terms of how we buy technology.
Yeah, you have to integrate into an aging technical architecture, but also a business architecture and a compliance architecture that they're not quite used to. So on the subject of challenges in Revolut, you know, they have started to talk about this crazy thing called profitability. At the same time, you know, Monzo and N26 are both saying, you know, in a post-COVID, you know, world, you know, they're worried, you know, are they going to make it? Starling is approaching profitability. The U.S. is a little more murky in terms of where people actually stand, as, you know, the big players here really just publishing their growth numbers, which themselves are interesting and a bit murky. How do you think this plays out with winners and losers?
Well, from my perspective, we are investors in both Revolut and N26. And there's, first of all, there's a difference between the two of them, but also just thinking about the model at large. And this is interesting because Michael and I have had ongoing debates on this very same topic for a long time now. But our thinking is that if you approach it from the incumbent's mindset, then what you're really doing is do everything they've done, but do it 10 times better. Right, do lending better, drive your costs down, and cut out the branches, and do all that stuff 10 times better. And you can see the path to how that gets done. But if you approach it from a perspective of what is financial services in the hands of an individual, then some of these players have come at it from different angles. So for example, Revolut started with a card in your hand, which gave you real-time FX at interbank rates. Right now, that proposition did not exist. So it got the card into many people's hands. Now, the card is just a form factor because it was the prelude to what banking would look like. They then tagged on a whole bunch of other stuff like insurance and like crypto and a variety of concierge and so on. And they've built an experience that actually landed them in a space where people were suddenly willing to pay for it. Now, bear in mind that in most of Europe, especially the UK, consumer banking is generally free. So why do you have these large swaths of people who are willing to pay $6.99 or $12.99 a month? It's not because they got a nice card. It's because the first thing is that they crossed this so-called trust chasm. And then the second thing is they built a proposition that people are willing to engage with on a much more frequent basis.
Well, I think they also crossed the value chasm. You know, when I look at the challengers and I see the, ooh, you get the upgraded card or a concierge chat, you know, I don't know that that's worth paying for. I think that becomes table stakes. Michael, I'm curious, you know, you're in UK, ground zero for all things fintech and where this is evolving. Where do you see the winners and the losers? And I know that might put you in a little bit of a difficult position because you serve all of them, but you know, is it the challengers? Is it some of the challengers? Which and you know, what happens to some of the incumbents?
Well, and I've always said for me, I can answer that question as a banker, or I can answer that question as someone who runs a technology company now. And these are two different perspectives, right? But, you know, ultimately, you know, for me, it comes down to, will the smart banks get big or the big banks get smart first? And, you know, at the end of the day, you do need scale. It's all about operating leverage. You need to have enough customers, otherwise it's hard to make money. You also need scale in terms of balance sheet efficiency. So you need to generate a decent net interest margin, which is easier if you have a big balance sheet because you have more products you can optimize. And on the other hand, you have the incumbents who have both scale and balance sheet, but maybe not yet the cost base that they need to be efficient. Now, what the current crisis and the potentially upcoming crisis means that both sectors will come under pressure. And one of the key drivers is obviously very low interest rates that we're seeing. So a lot of the revenue potential of any bank is in the net interest margin. And where current account balances, for instance, are not worth very much, it's harder to make money. So, and I think that will ultimately mean that there will be winners on both sides. So some of the larger challenger banks that can scale quickly will manage to get through that. And some of the big banks that can actually reinvent themselves also from a back office technology point of view, lower their cost base and gain the agility that they need to bring new products to the market more quickly, those are the ones that will actually win. So for me, it's not so much a question of will it be challengers or incumbents. For me, it's more of a question of can you get scale on the one hand and agility and a low cost base on the other and combine the two to basically create a viable proposition moving forward.
And those two things really do seem to always be in tension. The more scale I have, the less agile I am. It's harder to begin to change. I'm curious, when you think of scale, is it measured in number of customers or breadth of products? Because this is one of the other things where it gets murky for challenger banks is the more they tack on, to Vinod's point about other products associated with it to make them profitable, suddenly they look and feel just like a better version of an existing bank.
I think that's a very good point. And I think you can build scale with a limited set of products, but you need to be very, very good in that space, and you need to almost dominate it. And you can build scale with a lot of different products. So the global banks, the universal banks, the JP Morgans and the Citi of the world, they play in so many different markets that they have scale across the different product segments, and where it all comes together is in the efficient use of capital and balance sheet. So that gives them definitely an edge. On the other hand, I still believe that there's a very interesting market for niche players with a lot of scale from a customer point of view and a limited product offering, but they need to be very, very good in these products, whether that's supply chain financing, whether that is trade financing, whether that's transaction banking, whether that's lending. I think that there's a role that some of those players can actually play with a limited product set. But by and large, what we're seeing is basically that those banks are basically faring the best at the moment, those that have scale in terms of number of customers and number of products.
But I would argue that scale has to be underpinned by technology. And so the kind of thing that Form 3 does enables that to even become possible. So, you could be at 10 million users or 20 million users or whatever that number is, and it doesn't have this incremental cost effect. It does, but to a diminishing degree. So I think if the challengers are set up to think about what that means, then there is a world in which they don't think about net interest margin. That can exist.
Yeah.
And so I think that might be interesting.
Well, yeah, also the environment that they're operating in is not static, right? And as Vinod said earlier, any technology that you need to bring in, that you're bringing in today, will need to be able to respond to a fast-changing market environment. And that in the payments world is maybe the move towards ISO 20022. It might be the new payment infrastructure here in the UK, or it might be the global adoption of real-time payments. All of that needs to be implemented, which basically means existing technology that is difficult to adjust to these changes may become too expensive to run moving forward. That's the opportunity for us. Incumbent providers of these technologies have made a lot of money by effectively selling professional services to large financial institutions, to customizing systems. And I was a customer of that, right? So of course, if you define business requirements and technical requirements of those providers, they will build it for you. And you think you have a competitive advantage over the other banks out there. What that leads to is typically a dead end. So you have a highly customized system that needs to be changed, and every single industry change that is coming along will cost you. And that's why we started the company. If you're on a multi-tenanted service that you can configure but don't need to customize, we can actually implement those changes for all of our customers at once. And through the commercial model that we have, you don't pay for the change, you pay for the outcome, you pay for the product, you pay for the processing.
For the banks that have these highly inflexible big iron systems, do you think we're going to see more M&A between the banks that just aren't going to be able to get there on their own, that they go acquire a fintech, or a challenger bank that has a more nimble architecture? And at what point does that drop off? Because I look at, you know, the size of some of these challenger banks, and we'll hear, you know, VC friends talking about, oh, Chase is going to, you know, buy them. It's like, there's no way Chase is going to go, you know, buy them for their tech or their customers. They're too expensive. You know, Vinath, why don't we start with you? Because you've got to find an exit for these challengers. Where do you see that going?
I think the truth is, again, to the point about scale, some of these challengers reach a size and valuation that is large enough that I think at that point you've got investors who are sitting in at the top of that investment stack, right? Yep. Would be looking for an uptick from where they are. And I think that puts you very firmly in the category of an IPO as opposed to an acquisition. Now, if you were to go down the route of an acquisition, it's going to result in some kind of, or some group of people losing money. And typically, you know, the VCs are going to be at the top of that stack, and so they might get their capital paid out first. But again, it just results in this slightly suboptimal outcome. Now, having said that, we have seen in history, you know, some of these companies being acquired, for example, BPC and Fidor Bank. We've also seen BBVA and Simple. And so I think that tag-on play does work. But I think that the fundamental question is, what is the strategy of the bank? You know, yeah. And I would look at it from an incumbent's perspective as opposed to an N26 or a Revolut perspective.
Yeah, Michael, I'm curious in your perspective, because if you look at BBVA and Simple, you know, we just keep hearing again and again, you know, in the press, that, you know, that was hemorrhaging money. You know, they haven't fully integrated. It has not actually revolutionized their stack. Now, BBVA did that, you know, themselves, you know, and said, you know, we have to go rebuild what we have to be more competitive, to be cloud-based. But it wasn't, you know, based on the Simple stack that they ingested. And Michael, curious from your twin banker / technologist perspective, what is it going to take for the banks to get there?
Well, I guess the harsh reality is most mergers fail, right? And I think that ratio is even worse in financial services. So most bank mergers, I think, fail. There are some successes, but you know, the odds are against you. The thing is, I think there could be a viable route for a major bank to buy a challenger to get access to the technology that they've built, and then transition existing business and customers onto the new stack. I think that could work. But I think in general, there are not many of those opportunities out there, and not many of those options for banks. So that shortcut to just buy someone who's got a new stack might not be available to many of them. And I think even if that is available, it may not necessarily be successful. So unfortunately, I think many of those banks will have to keep investing in overhauling their existing infrastructure, either step by step or wholesale, by building a challenger, an internal challenger proposition on the side to remain viable in the years to come.
So is that why you just announced a partnership with Lloyds? Is that the alternative there, is the in-between, which is let's do something deeper than a vendor relationship, but build a true partnership with a tech company like yourselves?
Yeah, correct. I mean, the investment that Lloyds have made in the business, obviously underpinning a commercial relationship that we have announced a few weeks ago. And this is really about transitioning their existing payment infrastructure onto cloud native platforms and technologies. And that won't happen overnight. That is a step-by-step process, but a really exciting opportunity for us to work with a major bank with the scale of Lloyds on the one hand, to create operating leverage on our own platform by effectively processing billions of transactions on that platform moving forward. And for Lloyds, on the other hand, it's an exciting opportunity to participate in the upside of that, and also making sure that we're safe as a company to basically perform some of the core processes for them that they need to basically service customers on a daily basis.
Now, you just announced your Series C, $33 million. Congratulations, you know, a significant round, great players, including, you know, the Lloyds and, you know, the trust they've placed in you. What was it like raising around in the midst of, you know, lockdowns, global economic uncertainty? You know, were all of the diligence calls done by Zoom? You know, what was the entire process like?
Yeah, this is admittedly not a quick or easy round, and you know it's a strategic investment round. So again, we had to not only work on the investment process, but also the commercial transactions. Now, the commercial transactions predate the lockdown, so you know these are huge enterprise contracts that we've been working on for a long time. And therefore, you know, a lot of work on that side had already been done. The investment process and the related due diligence was indeed mostly done over Zoom calls and relevant workshops and obviously data rooms and everything that you would expect from, you know, any of those funding rounds. Was it more difficult because of the lockdown? Probably not. The pandemic have a negative impact on either process or valuation? Probably not, because we think we are in a space that is quite resistant to what we're seeing in the wider economy. The need for banks to upgrade their technology stack has become more evident, if anything.
Yeah, that has become acute, much like the pandemic.
Exactly. So what we're seeing right now is massive inbound interest from not only customers, but also investors. So from that perspective, I would say it's not been a negative experience. But overall, anyone who's done a major strategic investment round will probably agree that there's a lot of complexity in that and a lot of complexity in aligning the investors, the timings, the commercial deal and the investment deal. And to land all that on a sixpence at some stage is not easy.
Vinath, how has this changed your process? Are you only meeting entrepreneurs virtually when you're looking at new investments?
So if I look at this year and some of the deals we've announced, all of them have been virtually, but there have been face-to-face meets in the past. Because bear in mind, many of these investments, they take a long time to transpire because we invested Series A and B, more B than A. And so as a result of that, we would have met the entrepreneurs much earlier in the journey. And so the later stages, the meetings might have been fully on Zoom. In the case of this year, I mean, all the way from March till now, we have not had a face-to-face meeting with entrepreneurs. And so for us, kind of going through that journey has been a little bit extended, but it does mean that the intensity of it is a little bit more drawn out. And that means that you're having an investment committee pitch, you have an entrepreneur like Michael on Zoom, and it's sometimes hard to get all the questions in within that 45-minute slot. So then you might have a follow-on, which wouldn't have happened in person because there would have been a site chat, there would have been a hang around, there would have been follow-up questions. So you miss some of those things, but all it means is, you know, there's another Zoom. So I think what has happened is it's just taken slightly longer to make decisions, but the same decisions do get made.
Well, you know, in both getting commercial agreements done and investments done, I've always found it's what happens after the meeting, the ability, you know, to have dinner or to grab a drink or the talk in the hallway. Like we need the equivalent within Zoom, which is let's all get out of the meeting and have like the sidebar afterwards to catch the offhand comment or to overhear, you know, comments between founders or, you know, to get that executive sponsor's real opinion on who the blocker is going to be. So, yeah. Michael, I want to end with you. What is next for Form 3?
Well, obviously, we've raised some funding now, which basically allows us to invest in the product. So we're scaling the engineering team quite significantly, put a lot of that money, all of that money into R&D to build more product capability more quickly, and that is vertically in terms of more functionality into the platform. We're looking at data, we're looking at enhanced payment workflows, we're looking at cross-border and FX, but also horizontally in terms of more geographies, more gateways in more countries, more real-time payment systems that we can actually reach to satisfy the needs of some of our biggest customers who really want to use our stack is a sort of a very homogeneous way of getting into clearing and settlement systems around the globe.
Fantastic. Well, thank you both for joining us and for sharing your perspective on the evolving marketplace for both cloud and the banking ecosystem.
Thanks, Jason. That was great fun.
Thank you.
That's it for this week. If you like the show, make sure to give us a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform or share it with a friend or share it on social media.
You can listen to all of our more than 300 episodes, plus all of the other shows from Provoke.fm Media, and learn more about being a guest, a partner, or a sponsor, all at Provoke.fm.
We'll see you again next week with more Breaking Banks.